Call the meeting of the Senate Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect it's approximately 3:35 on this Friday afternoon. We have present with us today Senator Stedman on my left, Senator French on my right. We believe Senator Wilikowski will soon be calling in, and we will be hopefully soon joined by Senator Stevens. Senator Wagner and McGuire have been excused.
I'm on the line, Senator Passman. This is Bill Wilikowski.
All right. So we do with Senator Wilikowski on the phone. We have a quorum here today. Anyone in the audience, as always, please turn off your cell phones. We are trying not to interfere with any of the electronic signals from either the TV or the internal recording equipment. The purposes of today's meeting, and I do thank the commissioner, Commissioner Butcher, is to hear a variety of topics that we will begin the discussion or begin the dialogue today upon. And these are issues that will be affecting the major issues driving this session. They include the fall 2011 forecast, issues of tax credits, the new tax revenue management system that was approved in the capital budget a year ago, production tax audits under the ACES system, and much, much more. And so I think it's important that we get off on a good start. And so we welcome you, Commissioner Butcher, Deputy Commissioner Tangeman, and anyone else from the ABLE Department of Revenue staff. Certainly, if there's a question that arises, you know, they may be called up to help in the conveying of information. We do recognize Senator Giesel is in the audience. I don't see any other elected officials, but welcome to all. So, Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner, welcome to Senate Resources.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Butcher, Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. With me is Deputy Commissioner Bruce Tangeman. And if I could, I'd like to point out a few folks that are here with the department that work very hard on these issues and rarely get any kind of attention. Dan Stickle, as most of you know, the Assistant Chief Economist. Angela Rodell, who is our new Deputy Commissioner for Treasury, as well as, and I'll just zip through these quickly, on the phone in Anchorage, we have our new Tax Division Director, Matt Fonder, Deputy Tax Director, Joanna Bales, Acting Chief Economist, Sherry Nienheis, Petroleum Economic Policy Analyst, Cody Rice, two Petroleum Economists, Victoria Ferguson and Mike Redlinger, Commercial Analyst Tim Reihard, and our three Audit Masters, Donna Keppers, John Larson, and Lenny Deeds.
Impressive lineup, Commissioners.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think it should be recognized that it is an impressive lineup.
As you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, we're going to take a look at the fall 2011 forecast, tax credits, and the tax revenue management system, production tax audits, staffing levels for audits, data assessment project and regulations, and we know it's unlikely we finish this today, but you know, these are some of the things that we'll be touching on. Slide four goes a little bit into factors that affect production forecasting. As we talked about the fall 2011 revenue forecast, they fall primarily into the production side of things and the price side of things, and we'll start out with our production forecasting. I won't read through all of the things on the list, but basically our petroleum economists and petroleum engineer take a look at the, as well as certainly the operators that we work with to come up with a forecast, take a look at the geology of the area, a development plan, where they are with it, and when it is expected to complete. The commercial piece of it, what the project economics are for a particular field, a particular well, oil price and market conditions, government policy, access regulation, taxation, and then a production profile, the history of it.
If I could interject, Commissioner, you know, what has most intrigued me about this page is under paragraph three, commercial, under project economics, is if you could develop exactly what was done by the Department of Revenue, and you mentioned on a field basis or a well-by-well basis, and I'm trying to understand exactly, did you do internal rate of return, return on investment, rate of return, you know, what type of project economics may have been done and what process?
Sure, Mr. Chairman, we can get you details on that. The pieces that we're hitting on, it's kind of a big picture look at what goes into affecting production going up or production going down. But we'll make sure that we get back to you on specifically what the department's piece of taking a look at that is.
And I appreciate it. And I think that there's going to be a number of these areas. And, again, this is to some extent why I wanted to have this meeting, so that we could establish some of the factual foundation that will hopefully better guide decisions later on in this session.
And then finishing up, as I had mentioned, the stage of depletion of a particular field, a particular well, and then, of course, the timing. And a lot of that ties back to what the market conditions are as well as what the oil price is. Taking a look at this slide, and, of course, this is also a slide we've seen many times where it's split out between the history of our production from 2001 to 2011 and then forward to 2021. And the forecast you see in our revenue sources book includes all three elements on the right-hand side between currently producing, under development, and under evaluation, with currently producing simply being the wells that are currently producing and the estimates into the future on what level of production we will get from those. Under development being wells that are currently under development, are not producing, but expect to be producing in the near future. And then under evaluation would be something such as, say, Point Thompson, where they're not currently developing it with a set date in which it would begin production, but is something that we still need to keep in our forecast because there's enough industry focus on it and spending, and the belief is it'll be coming online. But it's by far the most speculative of the three different types.
Would it be possible, Commissioner, to identify in the under development categories which projects you're referencing, and then also the under evaluation, so that we can better understand what might be included in those various categories, so that it gives us a more complete understanding of where the production forecasts, what you relied upon.
Sure. I'd like to ask Cody Rice to respond to that, who is one of the two or three main folks in our econ group that helps put the production forecast together.
Senator Pascavan, this is Cody Rice, a petroleum economic policy analyst with the Department of Revenue.
Welcome. If we could just
we can definitely take a look at what we can break out in those categories, but generally speaking, we're limited by AS 4355-890. It's a specific regulation requiring aggregation of three or more producers before we can release specific taxpayer confidential information, which is almost entirely the basis of these production forecasts. So in certain circumstances, it's possible that we might be able to provide a name of a project or two, and where we are able to do that, that is already in the revenue sources book. But we'll certainly take a look at if it's possible to expand on that.
Just so that I understand, is the distinction that you're drawing is in fields that are fewer than three are not disclosed, and that more than three operators are disclosed? I mean, I just want to make sure I appreciate what you're indicating.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
And specifically, where in the revenue sources book would we have the list of the operators that are in the three or more producers that would be in the categories under development or under evaluation, just so that, again, we want to make sure that we're all on the same sheet of music, so to speak.
Mr. Chairman, we don't actually have a list in the RSB of which fields or units have three or more owners, because that actually changes periodically. But what I can do is take a look real quick here. I have it in front of me and list a couple of, on page 38 of your RSB, from the video I can see Senator Stedman has his, you can see production forecast assumptions, and in the far right column, a couple of projects are listed, including heavy viscous oil development at Orion, continued satellite development at Alpine, the Nanook, and Alpine Westfield, and continued development at Ugarik and Nikaichuk.
Right, and so is additionally, if I'm understanding, then the names of the producers under these categories, if there are three or more, can be disclosed, or it's just the production totals?
Mr. Chairman, the details of production and taxpayer particular information can only be disclosed under AS 4355-890 if there are three or more owners or producers that it can be aggregated among. So, for instance, if you'll take a look at page 41 of your RSBs, there are two paragraphs there that describe currently under development and currently under evaluation. And for projects under that are listed as currently under development, we list the Nanook, Alpine West satellites, Alpine, Borealis, and Orion satellites at Prudhoe Bay, in development drilling at Liberty, Ugarik, and Nikaichuk, and ongoing development drilling at Prudhoe Bay and Kaparik. And I think that's an important distinction to make, that some of these under development layers particularly are actually occurring in currently producing fields. So there may be multiple layers within a single field, if that makes sense. Prudhoe Bay has both currently producing and under development.
Correct. Any further information needed on that from, I believe the committee is with you on that so far, so.
Just for clarity's
sake. Were there further questions?
Just for clarity's sake, and the 1 million barrel a day aspirational goal set by the governor has been much on the mind of the public. As they look at this graph, I don't know that they would see where that million barrels appears. I think it's fair to say that wherever that's going to come from, it's neither currently producing, it's neither under development, nor it's under evaluation. Is that fair? The difference between the 500,000 barrels a day I'm seeing in this graph and the 500,000 you need to add to that to make a million?
Through the chair, Senator French, that is correct. This is a snapshot of how the department, in talking to the operators, sees the production forecast moving forward in the current investment environment, which is different than what a future investment environment would look like upon passage of HB 110 or doing some of the things DNR are working on. And I think the governor gives his million barrels a day kind of as a big picture of the many different steps he's taking to try to get there. So the department believes that under the current investment climate that 1 million barrels a day wouldn't be achievable in the next decade.
Just a follow-up question on that. And where does, say, Great Bear's shale oil efforts fall in here? Would that be under evaluation?
Through the chair, Senator French, that is not currently on this. It is something that's being discussed, but the first exploration well hasn't been drilled. It's far too premature. We don't know if it's even the type of shale that can be produced, and there are so many unanswered questions that it's certainly something the department is keeping its eye on, working on what potentially that kind of development would look like, as well as the Department of Natural Resources. But it isn't at the level that we see it under serious evaluation in the near future until there's more information.
And to add one point, Senator French, and Ms. Nienhuis can correct me if I'm wrong, but we are taking into account their potential CapEx and OpEx plans going forward. So we know they're a serious player that way. We're assuming they're going to be investing CapEx and OpEx, but we're not to the stage where we can start projecting production from those potential fines.
And just last question on this point, if I may, Mr. Chairman. Have you developed a graph of how you get to 1 million barrels a day under HB 110 and where it would come from? Have I seen that?
Through the chair, Senator French, no, that has not been developed. We put together the graphs on potentially what different size production fields would look like, and DNR has done work as well. But seeing as it's into the future and we don't have a definite view of exactly what's going to happen over the next 10 years, we do not.
We did, Senator French, to follow up, we did have some scenarios in House Finance last year where we did have some potential scenarios, and they were based on some publicly available information. So we weren't just throwing a dart at the wall and saying 1 million barrels. We were saying, and Mr. Stickle can give us details, he helped produce that, but they were based on certain types of fields and potential there. So there was some structure to them to get us to that 1 million barrel.
Thank you.
You know, in your slide 5 here, you show a decline from 2001 for approximately the last decade. But I think we all are in agreement that decline started in approximately 1989. I think that's pretty much we're in agreement on that. And I guess on a general sense, what's the basis or what was the reason for the onset of decline at Prudhoe Bay beginning in 1989?
Chairman Pascvan, as has been stated, most fields realize a natural decline. So the decline that we were seeing, which happens to track identically with Texas's decline, was a natural decline. But what you have to continually bring to this discussion is the price of oil. And we've presented other graphs. We don't do it here, but I always include the price of oil laid in during that time, because you can talk about a decline happening in the 80s and 90s, but you also have to account for the oil prices that were bumping around between $9 and $20, and they were very low oil prices. So during that time, most fields were seeing decline. Texas and Alaska were tracking on the exact same decline curve for 10 or 15 years. The difference is when you see the oil prices start to spike in early 2000 into mid-2000s, our decline continues, yet you see Texas's flatten out and turn around, as well as North Dakota, which is a new player, obviously, and Alberta, which is also turning around. So anytime you talk about decline, I believe including the price of oil is a critical factor.
Well, it raises an interesting issue in that regard. What is your understanding of the gas handling capacity as compared to the oil production capacity as a constraint on the North Slope fields since 1989 to the present?
Mr. Chairman, that is a question that the Department of Natural Resources would be able to answer better than the Department of Revenue. We have not been in discussion with anybody that has discussed that as being a hindrance to development, but that doesn't mean the Department of Natural Resources hasn't had a conversation about it.
And certainly, sir, industry would certainly be able to shed a lot of light on that, so I look forward to hearing answers to those questions in front of this committee.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple quick points. It'd be nice if we're looking back at this, take a look at another data point in that I think back in the late 70s, the oil industry or the TAPS was looking at running out of oil and at some time right after the turn of the century, which would be roughly a decade ago. So it'd be nice to, you know, put this in historic review, because appears to me that we're dealing with a normal decline curve in a field, and I've never seen in the books that we've reviewed where they have tied advancing prices into alterations of the production curve in their analytical models dealing with their fiscal regimes. So maybe they're out there, but I haven't stumbled into them yet. And also when we, the fiscal review of the projects, the full cycle accounting, they have a rapid increase in production followed by a long tapering decline, which we're faced here, and you see that in numerous places.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, that is true, but as Deputy Commissioner Tangeman said, as we began doing research of other oil-producing jurisdictions, including Texas, that's been producing oil 80 years longer than we have, it was amazing to see the flattening out and the upturn of all of these jurisdictions when the price of oil began to get up $80, $90, $100 a barrel, with the exception of the state of Alaska. There's certainly been technological advancements that have played a role in that. However, they're simply the economics of a project, quite obviously at $80 or $90 or $100 a barrel, is going to make many developments pencil that wouldn't pencil at $10 or $20 or $30, as we saw bumping around in the years or even decades previous to the last 5 or 6 years.
Senator French.
I have to ask one more question about Texas if we're going to start trying to model ourselves upon them, and I certainly hope we're not, but just for the purposes of an open discussion, what percentage of the new production in Texas from, pick a number, I think you threw out the year 2000 when oil prices started to turn around, what percentage of that new production in Texas is conventional and how much is unconventional?
Through the chair, Senator French, almost all of that is conventional. We talked to the Commissioner of Revenue in the state of Texas, and actually that was one of my first questions. As I saw 10 or 15 years of the two states going the same decline curve and then Texas flattening out and beginning to go back up, my first thought was, well, we know of Eagle Ford Shale. We know of these shale plays that are being developed in Texas that are being developed in Alaska. And he explained that almost entirely the flattening out and the beginning to creep up had to do with conventional oil plays that had become more economic at the price of oil, and that in the next 2, 3, 5 years, we're really going to see that curve begin to increase as they begin to, in mass quantities, develop the shale oil.
Thank you.
Commissioner, again, now that we're on the topic of Texas, you know, we were in Austin, Texas, as part of this Energy Council in December, and one of the statements that was provided to us is that the average well in Texas produces 5 barrels a day. And that's, you know, these stripper wells that they can turn on and turn off pretty rapidly. You know, certainly it would make intuitive sense to me that if you have thousands or maybe even tens of thousands of these stripper wells, that you can turn on a lot of stripper wells because the price is $100 a barrel, and therefore you have conventional oil extraction from these wells that are producing 5 barrels a day. Is that is my initial thought accurate or not?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that certainly could be a possibility. However, most of the discussion when we were in Texas talking to them, they went to different areas that were having an explosion of exploration, development, and production that hadn't currently been occurring. West Texas and also South Texas. And many of those stripper wells have had most of the capital and most of the investment already put into them. So even though they are only producing 5 barrels, 10 barrels a day, even at $30 a barrel, that's still making the company money, and it would still be profitable for them to produce what they could produce unless it got to a really cost prohibitive number.
And if you could provide to this committee the data that you were referencing as far as, you know, the increases or decreases correspondingly, so that we can share that information with each other.
Absolutely, Senator. We did a lot of phone calls back and forth with our counterparts in these other oil-producing jurisdictions, so we can fill you in on some of those details.
Thank you. Senator Stedman.
Chairman, I think one clear distinction, and some of this stuff will be, I guess, repeated as we go forward, but we need to make sure that the public understands some of these nuances that when we're dealing with Texas or Oklahoma, we're dealing with private individuals that own the subsurface rights. Where in Alaska, the state owns all the subsurface, and we're the only state in the union like that. Mm-hmm. So a direct correlation between us and Texas or Oklahoma or even North Dakota has some logistical challenges to it because we don't have several thousand individual people up there all owning, you know, a few acres in the subsurface under their land that they can just go put a, you know, a well on. Got some just, go ahead.
No, through the chair, Senator Stedman. No, that's absolutely true. And in fact, if we lay everything out, there are many situations, and that's certainly one of them that make it different. Being able to drive straight on to a drill pad and the labor that's easy to get as a result is a big difference. And in fact, that's one of the big hurdles the state of Alaska deals with. We have more reserves. Estimated reserves than just about any other oil-producing jurisdiction in North America, yet the cost of producing a barrel of oil is so much higher than anywhere in the country that's a definite hurdle that Alaska has to deal with in looking at the big picture of increasing or flattening out and then increasing our production.
If the recovery rates, for example, for Prudhoe, Kuparuk, some of the major Alaska fields, what are your estimates of those recovery rates, and how do you? And has there been any comparison, for example, with recovery rates from Texas, North Dakota, Oklahoma, so that we can have an understanding of some comparison between these jurisdictions?
We'll look into getting that for you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
Well, we're on that subject. It looks like from the little handout you just gave me earlier, looks like Norway's declined in 08 to 010 from 2,463 to 2,001,000, and UK 1,548 to, I think these are in billions, to 1,003,000,000. So it looks like Norway, which we spent a lot of time comparing ourselves 2 years ago, and the UK North Sea have similar trends as Alaska, just on those three data points. So maybe when we talk about response to the high oil prices, we need to broaden our horizon out beyond Texas and Oklahoma and a few places that
through the chair, Senator Stedman. Holistically. That is a good point, and we certainly will be broadening our discussion. I would like to point out that in that discussion, comparing to Norway, perhaps we should compare the United States to Norway, seeing as how Norway is a country, Alaska is a state. Now, granted, our resources are very vast and plentiful, so maybe on a reserves basis, we are comparable in that way, but it is country to country, and I think it's important to keep that in mind. That was why it was so critical for, we understand a large group went to Norway to look into their system. We thought it was very important to compare ourselves to our immediate neighbors, our North Dakota, or our North American counterparts. And that's why we spent so much time with Alberta and North Dakota and Texas. They're on this continent, they're our direct competition, and we knew Norway was being covered quite well by a large group, so we thought it was important to spend a lot of time on our North American counterparts.
Senator Stedman.
Mr. Chairman, it's early in the discussion here, and our consultants will speak for themselves, but I would expect when they come forward, they'll be comparing us to other exporting hydrocarbon basins and possibly some of the states, but comparing us up against some of our international competitors in exporting basins. So, this is, I think, the third major time we've gone through this, first time with PPT, second time with ACES. But we've always taken a global view of what we're dealing with. So we'll just keep that in mind as we go along, and we'll be having, I'm sure, additional presentations coming forward of how we sit relative to our competitive basins. But I think the universe will be broader than that, broader than what's being talked about here today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Commissioner, I think it would be also important, in addition to comparing, for example, reserves information from countries, but also comparing the fiscal systems of the countries. So ultimately, that's part of what we're going to be doing down here in Juneau this year is the fiscal system analysis. So.
Yeah, I agree with that, Mr. Chairman, and that's a lot of what we tried to do in the document that Senator Stedman refers to. It really is difficult in trying to compare the fiscal systems of Alaska to anywhere. As you know, our tax credit system's much different. Another example is Alberta. The province makes their money off royalties and not on taxes, whereas we, a little bit of both, but far more in taxes than in royalties. So there is a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done to dig through these and come to a pretty good idea of fiscally how they all match up. It's not an easy apples to apples. So my long-winded way of agreeing with you.
And, Commissioner, I do thank the Department of Revenue. I think that its oil and gas fiscal regime report that has recently come out is very helpful in that regard. So, any further questions, committee members? Please continue.
Slide 6 is a page out of the RSB, page 39. This is a chart that has been in the RSB for several years with one slight modification. The third column over, which is the percent change from prior year on the currently producing only, is a new column. In previous years, we went from currently producing plus under development plus under evaluation for total ANS, and then the only percent change was the final column. I felt it was critical based on the commissioner and I sitting in this seat 1 year ago today and other committees, the incredible response and the energy that's put into the pointing out the forecasts that have been done in the past and the overly optimistic forecasts. I thought it was important to put another sideboard on this discussion. When you're only looking at the far right column, you only have one sideboard. And a lot of work goes into this by the department, by the producers, and discussions back and forth to get that as accurate as possible. But the important part to remember is currently producing is the most solid part. We have a very good handle on that, we believe. The underdevelopment and under-evaluation are both more speculative. They will require and assume a certain level of capital and operating expense to achieve those numbers. But it's not an automatic that those will occur. Liberty, things along those lines are easy examples to say that they appeared in one of those columns, but for various reasons were kicked back by the producers. So I thought it was important to put that third column in as another sideboard so we can have a discussion between this and that as the potential production numbers for the next 10 years out.
In looking at this slide 6, you know, the thought came to my mind, you know, we receive from time to time the USGS layout of, you know, the whole north shore of Alaska, whether it's ANWR, Central North Slope, OCS, you know, kind of the whole layout. But they give their opinions in a range of forecast with a point on there that they believe is, you know, their highest probability, or I can't remember what it was, a P2 or whatever that exact terminology was. And so what came to my mind is, what with your forecasting is the range, for example, of these numbers, and do you go through that similar type of a P1, P2, probability forecasting?
I think Mr. Rice could probably give you a brief description on that would be very informative.
Mr. Chairman, this is Cody Rice, Petroleum Economic Policy Analyst for the Department of Revenue. We do not do probabilistic forecasting for the production forecast, and I believe our current production forecaster, Frank Molly, spoke to this last session when he explained that we don't believe that that would provide lawmakers with a lot of value, because the range would be very wide in the out years. In the near term, say 1 year out, maybe 2 years out, it could perhaps be instructive, and that's something we could consider taking a look at. But when you're talking about a long-term forecast that we're producing beyond 10 years out, the sideboards on that probabilistic estimate would be very, very large.
You know, I understand that, you know, maybe going 10 years out with that whole concept of under development, under evaluation, and technology, but I guess more in the near term, you know, 3 to 5 years, is there a range without having any probabilistic Monte Carlo analysis or anything like that, but just is there a range of forecast, you know, is that done?
Well, Senator Passman, I think that's the important first step in this layout. We do have a range now. The currently producing is something that is we have great confidence in, especially in that five-year window that you mentioned. So I think that provides us a very solid range. The work that goes into analyzing the under development and under evaluation, I think, is solid as to the resource. The variable would be the capital and operating that would need to go in to realize that resource. So I think this is a very good, I don't want to say high end and low end, because it could be lower or it could be higher, but I think this is a very good range to begin that discussion.
Well, maybe I'm miscommunicating. I look at, for example, 2012, and I see 0.548. I don't see a range there, you know, and what I'm wondering, do you have 0.053 as the low end of the range and a 0.56 at the high range? You know, what is there some process or procedure that gives you a band that you operate within?
Mr. Chairman, to add a little bit to what Mr. Rice had said, you know, as we go through analyzing what each operator, each well, and what they are seeing in the out years, as we know, the further out we get, the less accurate they are. But if there's one thing we've noticed consistently over the years, regardless of who the forecaster was, it's that we end up being on the optimistic side as we look at the production side of the forecast. We, year after year, end up producing less than we expect to produce. And we get that information from the operators. And so I guess if we were to try to do some probabilistic, this could almost be seen as the high side, because rarely do we end up at this level, whether it's a delay in a project, a shutdown that's unplanned, because we have the planned shutdowns factored into it. So it would be something we could look at, you know, trying to do something with, but it would almost certainly be to the lower end, since we tend to be just the nature of it year after year a bit on the high end when it comes to our production estimates.
You know, I've always heard that it takes 7 to 10 years for a well to come online. Are you in agreement that's kind of what is anticipated or expected?
Mr. Chairman, a new field starting from an exploratory well to production, that's the averages that we've seen from AOGCC.
And the thought that came to my mind then is for example, in 2012, the wells that are anticipated to be flowing this year is as a result of decisions that were made then 2005 to 2002. And so I guess my question is doesn't this indicate then that this was a decision made between 2002 and 2005?
Mr. Chairman, the currently producing and are, you know, Prudhoe Bay, Kuparuk, and what they're doing with infield drilling in those particular areas, we'd look back 7 to 10 years on a field that might be coming into production today. And as an example, Nikaichuk and Ugaruk have come online in the last couple of years, and that's something that took place at that approximate time. But we don't have anything we see coming online this year that had begun that. This is mostly dealing with the currently producing fields, the mega fields, if you will, Prudhoe Bay, Kuparuk, Alpine, and what they're producing.
Senator French.
I'm glad you made that clarification, because I think a lot of the times the public is confused about the, you know, that 7 to 10 year number and thinks that you can't get oil into the pipeline. You know, if you start now, it takes 7 to 10 years. You and I know that's not true, and you just explained that, but it's important to reemphasize that. At Pruitt and Kuparuk, you can punch a hole in the ground and you're on an existing pad, probably recompleting a well that's already been done once before. You're drilling through an established wellhead. You're going to put that stuff online just right around very, very quickly. But I guess the question is what would happen if you know, you suddenly drilled? I mean, we're running like 150 wells a year on the North Slope, you know, roughly. A little bit high, a little bit low, but that's roughly the number of wells that get drilled every year on the North Slope, 150 wells. What would happen if you turned that, you doubled that number? Would the Prudhoe Bay Reservoir start pumping a lot more oil out, or is there just not more to get there because it's a 30-year-old reservoir?
Through the chair, Senator French, I can attempt to answer that. I think DNR or AOGCC could probably give you a better estimate of it, but I think a lot of it would have to do with the kinds of wells you were drilling. A lot of it would have to do with the pressure. I mean, we all know there are reinjecting 8 to 8.5 billion cubic feet a day of gas to keep the pressure up. And so I don't know enough about the details of the field as you get from DNR to AOGCC to tell you exactly what would happen then. But I think there'd be a number of factors you'd have to go into to figure that out.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. Please continue.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, on page 7, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but it's just kind of a snapshot of what 300 barrels a day would mean in terms of today's numbers, what the budget is, what we would see our numbers coming from at this level, and what kind of a deficit we'd be looking at, what it would take in taxes and everything. And this is just something that kind of tries to make the point that the governor tries to make about how important it is to work to flatten out our decline curve and eventually turn it around, because as we have right now, as well as other small population states, as we all know, it's a difficult situation if we don't get everything we can out of our natural resources.
You know, Commissioner, my assumption is that you're using the current tax system in this calculation. Is that accurate?
The current tax law?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Have you analyzed what this would look like if you applied HB 110?
We have not, Mr. Chairman.
Could you calculate that or give a rough estimate? You know, I mean, how long would it take right now to just run a HB 110 analysis on these exact numbers using these assumptions?
Mr. Chairman, that's certainly something we can try to put together, although I will say if HB 110 passed and we continued to see the kind of reduction that would get to 300,000 barrels a day, I can't imagine the policymakers keeping that particular tax in place. The intention of the tax is to increase and improve the investment climate and increase the investments, development, and projection, and which goes kind of counter to what would be happening if we were to hit 300,000. Well, we can work something up for you.
Yeah, I would request then that you, using the same assumptions that you have set forth in slide 7, is to do that calculation, assuming HB 110 were the tax system in place.
Sure.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Steadman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just, you know, looking at the revenue source book going out to 2021, we're still 462,000 barrels versus the 300 here. So I don't know how far out in the future 300 is on the target. I don't have that information in years. And then I have a follow-up.
Certainly.
Yeah, we just took this as a – actually, when the discussion first started on this, it was as a result of the study that Alyeska had done over the summer about where they would really start realizing some difficulties in oil flowing down the pipeline, which was roughly 300, 350. That's just where we took the number. You're correct, Senator, that it's years, hopefully many, many years to decades, that we will receive 300,000 barrels a day. Certainly true. Also true, the size of our budget will almost certainly be much, much higher during that period of time, too. So this is just kind of a snapshot trying to show how important oil and gas production is to the state.
Very good. So follow, Mr. Chairman, because one of the things as we go forward over the next 30 days that, you know, I'd like to see is that we're a little careful that we don't inadvertently push alarm bells that aren't needed to be pushed. As I think back here, when we did original PPT, we put in a 20% capital credit to help offset the heavy cost of heavy oil and to try to get a response out of our legacy fields to increase production. So we've been addressing this situation along with credits and a lot more extensive credit availability under ACES, you know, a couple years later and through to till today. So I can't imagine that the state of Alaska would sit back and just watch a decline with billions and billions of barrels in the Arctic and watch the decline volume continue to erode. And I'd also like to point out, Mr. Chairman, that when we had a similar situation in Cook Inlet, we spent almost every winter here having meetings on Cook Inlet, working with Cook Inlet, changing the fiscal structure of Cook Inlet with ring fencing and credits, and even through last year, trying to get more gas and oil production in Cook Inlet. So, and that appears to be working. So I just want to, you know, the folks at home to realize when we walk through these assumptions that are way out in the future, our job is to see that some of these things, you know, never materialize, and we all want to get the oil stabilized in flow of 600,000 barrels a day, maybe get it up to 700,000 barrels a day, or maybe even north of there. But no one's going to sit around and watch billions and billions of barrels be stranded in the Arctic. I mean, that's just not going to happen.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, that is true, and having discussions around 300,000 barrels a day, that is a depressing discussion to have right now, considering the resource we have. But I do point back to slide 6, and that's why I think it's critical to have that other sideboard in the discussion, because we do see 307 in 2018, which is a mere 6 years away. So that's not a, you know, I don't want to be talking doomsday scenarios, but I also think it's critical to have that discussion that in 2018 we have 307,000 barrels and currently producing. We really need 171,000 barrels from under development and 66,000 from under evaluation to get back up to 544. So that's really the heart of this table, is to put that other sideboard in there to point out how critical capital is to bring under development and under evaluation online.
Please continue, Commissioner.
Thank you. Taking a look at our production forecast, improvements in methodology, and this is something that I'm sure has been occurring at the Department of Revenue far before when I got here, but I know that in my many years working for the House and Senate Finance Committees, we saw from the outside view the same thing that I now see from the inside view, which is we seem to year in and year out forecast more production than really occurs. So we've been trying to dig down into the numbers and try to see what we can do, not to come up with a smaller number, but to come up with a more accurate number, so a year from now we can look back and see that we are getting closer and closer to being able to forecast where we're going to be than we have been in the past. As a result of that, we've worked over the interim to create standardized reporting forms for production forecasting information. We used to get information from operators and all different kinds of forms, and it took a lot of time to take a look and work through all of them to come up with it. We're now getting them filling in standardized reporting forms. It's making it much easier for our econ team to work through the information and gives them more time to get into other things. We've also been digging down much more into extensive well and field specific data than we have previously. As a result, we've also focused very closely on what the decline curves, what we believe them to be, on all of the operating wells. And so it's been a focus in much more detail than we have previously done, and we hope that comes up with a more accurate number.
Commissioner, one of the questions that arose in my mind was how do the big three oil companies perform their internal production forecasting? It's my understanding that they use a field analysis as compared to well by well.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that that well by well forms the field for them because they, well, actually, I was going to say, instead of going into detail, could I please get Cody Rice to kind of weigh in on this?
Mr. Chairman, this is Cody Rice, Petroleum Economic Policy Analyst for the Department of Revenue. The answer to your question is it depends. It depends on the company. It depends on the field. Different companies do everything from rough estimates based on publicly available information for fields that they don't have well data on to sophisticated 3D reservoir models that cost millions and millions of dollars and involve supercomputers and teams of engineers. But even at the most sophisticated level, the 3D reservoir models, those have information on individual wells. So I argue that they are looking at it on a well-by-well basis.
I guess my question is, do they do their production forecasting based on a field basis?
I'm not sure I understand that question. What I was trying to communicate is that they're forecasting and have production estimates for individual wells and for the aggregated field for most of the instances that I'm aware of. But it would really depend on the individual company. And that includes different companies within the same field. Different working interest owners will have different estimates for production at the same field.
We can continue or move on.
And they may use slightly different methodologies and assumptions as well.
Now, Mr. Chairman, on slide 10, we're going to dig into a little bit on the other side of the forecast, the price forecast, which is something that I know in previous years there, and I say this because the years I worked in the Senate Finance Committee, the Department of Revenue used to have, you know, an expert, the chief economist, that would come out with what the estimate was for the next year, and those were during very lean times, and there were many questions as to where it came from and how it got there, and were politics playing into it, and I'm not accusing anybody of anything, but there were then a lot of other issues that were being looked at. Cambridge Energy Research Associates was hired by the legislature for a number of years to try to give a different view of what the potential price was. And I'm happy to tell you that when I took this job a year ago, as of 3 or 4 years ago, they had really changed how they'd done this. Not that I'm not saying that the number was any much more accurate than it had been in the past, but they started what they called Delphi, and I think there's a different name to it now. But it brings a large group of people in a room, and Mr. Chairman, we were happy to have you as well as Jeff there this year. And we have a number of experts come in, talk about where they see prices going, talk about major issues, talk about potential. A good example is this year there was a tremendous amount of conversation between the difference between WTI and ANS, because traditionally Alaska North Slope oil had been a couple of dollars a barrel under West Texas Intermediate. That flipped a year 18 months ago, and in fact I think it was $25, $28 premium for ANS at the time we were doing this than WTI. So digging into why that is, was it going to change, how long it was going to change, was a significant part of what we talked about. But the nice thing about it is we had members of the econ team from the Department of Revenue, DNR, University, ICER, David Teal from the legislature. We've had Greg Erickson, and we've sent invites out to a number of different folks to come in to participate. So not only do we get a view from a wider group of people, but we also have many more people being able to view how this is done and how we come to what we come to. So when we come out and say, okay, our projected FY13 is 104.20, nominally 109.47, people understand how we got to 109.47. It's not a mystery that may or may not have errors in it, depending on who was working on it. So this gives you an idea. The nominal price for the out years, as you can see, and then in the front, the real, which is giving you what the value of the price would be in the out years, inflation, taking into account the inflation rate of 2.5% a year.
No questions from the committee?
Just, I think it's worth, if I could, Mr. Chairman, just to get the Commissioner of Revenue on the record about the persistent price differential that we're enjoying over West Texas Intermediate, when that began, and how long you expect it to persist.
Through the chair, Senator French, I think it began, and I'm not exactly sure on this, but it seems to have occurred a year to 18 months ago. And it went up very quickly to 25. I think it peaked at about 28.
In mid-September.
Yeah. And as we discussed it with the experts, they all were under the impression, interestingly enough, they all kind of had a different reason as to why it was occurring, which is kind of interesting. But it seems like in general they thought there was kind of a regional glut of oil, and that there simply weren't enough pipelines to get the amount of oil to the Gulf of Mexico to have an effect on the price. And so they saw eventually that capital work being done and it beginning to come more in line, with the idea being WTI would move up to a far greater degree than it is ANS would move down, which is reassuring from Alaska's point of view. And then what occurred was, between the time we came out with this and, say, a month ago, it came much closer, much faster than we thought it was going to. And I think it got as close as $4, $5. It's now begun to widen, and I haven't talked to anybody and gotten any kind of expert opinion on why that's happening again. But I think it's gone up to 8, 9, and a little over $10. A barrel now, so it appears to be going back up, which isn't what we anticipated, but that's, to the degree we know it, that's the best I can kind of tell you on what's going on.
And just to add one quick point, back in the fall when, the discussions down south were how to build more pipelines and the reversal of pipelines, Keystone XL was one, Wrangler, the Seaway pipeline was an interesting one. I believe that's the one that they're attempting to reverse flow from. It was coming from the Gulf Coast into Cushing, and I believe now they're trying to reverse it from Cushing to the Gulf Coast. And I don't know the exact effect it had, but it had an immediate effect on that delta between ANS and WTI. So one announcement on one pipeline can really have a big, big change on that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I believe we're now on slide 11.
This gives you a breakdown both for the current FY12 as well as our estimates for FY13 on what we expect the general fund unrestricted revenue coming into the state. The numbers in dollar amounts and then a total, and then to the right of them, it just for your information, gives you a idea of what percent we receive from each of these, with, as you can see, the production tax being between half and two-thirds of what we bring in. The royalty a little less than a quarter, and then a much smaller amount for corporate income tax, non-oil revenue, and then a very small amount for property tax.
Just as a point of clarification, and I'm following exactly what you're saying, but so that there's not a misunderstanding in any of the listening audience, our production tax is not 57.4%. That is the percentage of the of the revenue, because I think if you look at it as a percentage of the annual production, we're at about 21%, and if you look at it as a percentage of production tax value, we're at, I think, in the mid-30s. In other words, there's different numbers.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman. This is showing a percentage of the total amount of revenue coming in. So when royalty is at 23.4%, that tells you that 23.4% of the expected total revenue coming in will be getting from royalty.
Senator Stedman.
Mr. Chairman, just a point of clarification also, just for the folks at home, because a lot of times we take a look at total revenue coming into the state, not unrestricted general fund versus restricted general fund revenue. Because if we looked at the entire revenue stream, we're probably about a billion light on royalties, 400 million light on property tax, and corporate income tax might, I'm not sure if that, probably a minor, if any, effect on that, and same with the production of property tax, production and progressivity, probably not much adjustment on that, but we always struggle, I know, to try to take a look at the entire picture of what we're dealing with. And it gets confusing to people when some presentations are in total revenue, some are in unrestricted general funds. Because unrestricted general funds, Mr. Chairman, is just of interest, quite frankly, to the Finance Committee in our budgeting.
Yeah, as an example, through the chair, Senator Stedman, just for folks, the public paying attention, a good example of something that would not be included in here would be something like tuition for the University of Alaska, which is income coming in for the state, but it's not unrestricted. It's used specifically for the University of Alaska funding, and there's many other areas like that when you're taking a look at the total state budget. This is strictly funds coming in unrestricted, have no strings attached, can be used for anything, and they aren't targeted for something specific.
And just one additional point, that does lead to the revenue source book in general. You know, Brian and I had we viewed this book for many, many years. We've used it. We've read it. But this was the first year that we actually went through the process of how it's put together. And there are several different ways to look at the revenue pie in here. But just it was a fascinating process watching the staff put this thing together. It's a pretty incredible endeavor. It takes several months to put together. And I would like to commend them on the job they do. I've never seen the process before, and it's a pretty big lift for them in the fall.
Now, if we could, Mr. Chairman, I would like to shift to production tax credits. And Lenny Dees, our master auditor, is in Anchorage and is excited to address these for you.
Mr. Dees, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Lenny Dees, Audit Master with the Department of Revenue, and I'm going to today just give an update on production tax credits. Starting with slide 13, this slide shows by year the production tax liability, the production tax credits that were applied against the production tax liabilities. 2011 and 2012 have not been finalized yet because they're pending, the true-ups that we will be getting in March for the 2011 number, and then 2012 is an estimate includes an estimate for what we anticipate to be applied against production tax liabilities through the end of June. So that number now stands cumulative since PPT and ACES at almost $2.5 billion tax credits having been applied against production tax liabilities. On the next slide, slide 14, is a chart that's showing the amount of tax credit claims we've received by fiscal year. As through the end of December 2011, we've received applications for a transferable tax credit certificate totaling $1.7 billion.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Stedman.
Maybe before we go on, Mr. Dees, you can clarify. Looking at slide 13, we're showing about, in 12, about $400 million in total credits. And I assume that, I recollect that that's roughly the number we had in our budget documents, presentations last year. And then when we go to the next slide, slide 14, it was somewhere in the mid-fours, but you're showing 118 with a footnote. It's through December 2011. So could you help us with why the discrepancy from the slide numbers are dealing with fiscal year 12?
Okay, on slide 13, we're only talking about tax credits that have been applied by companies against their tax liabilities. Now, these are not necessarily inclusive of the transferable tax credit certificates. The information on slide 14 are primarily the explorers or the companies that are not yet producing, who don't have a tax liability, and they are the ones who are applying for tax credit certificates and will be converting those certificates to cash for the most part. Now, and I think I know where you're going. On the next slide, slide 15, is where, you know, where slide 14 shows what's been applied for. Slide 15 shows the actual credits that have been issued by year. And the first line of that particular slide shows that, you know, we've had $1.5 billion, of that $1.7 billion on the previous slide that were requested, we have issued $1.5 billion worth of credits. Of that $1.5 billion, we have about $1.3 billion of refunds that the state has actually paid out to these companies. Now, the other $400,000 that you're probably referring to is what we will actually be paying out in cash during fiscal year 2012. As you can see that on the line that says refunded, in fiscal year 2011, we paid out about $450 million. For fiscal year 2012, this number, the 273, is a number that is just what we've actually paid out through a certain date. We are estimating, however, in the budget, that that number will be around $400 million. So that's probably what you're referring to, is the fact that we have $400 million in the budget for what we're estimating will be paid out in cash.
So the expectation, if I could, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
So the expectations for 2012 so far are on track to our expectations a year ago when we were sitting here, roughly a total of $860 million in credits, with about roughly 63 or 60-some million of that was targeted at Cook Inlet. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Sir, Stedman, through the chair. Yes, at that time we had projected that in the number that we projected for that year, we did include the Cook Inlet jack-up rig credit, which we don't really think is going to come to fruition because of the delays in that activity. So,
Mr. Dees, just if I can cumulatively, we got the on page 13, we have the 2.5 approximately. On page 14, we have the 1.7. And then if I understand, there's another $200 to $300 million that we add on top of that. So roughly the credits structures are for these years are about $4.5 billion?
No. the way to read this is on slide 13, the $2.5 billion is what's been applied against tax liabilities, okay? And you would add that to what's on slide 15, the top line, the $1.5 billion that have been, you know, that are credit certificates that have been issued to companies. So if you wanted to see what the total impact of the credits have been since inception, you would add those two numbers together. And the as of through the end of the, you know, my projection based on these numbers would mean that that's a, about a $3.9 billion impact. And I have a slide that's kind of showing that number, my last slide here on slide 17.
Well, yes, Senator Stanton.
But that still leaves us about $300 million light to the end of the fiscal year, doesn't it?
Right.
So you need to add...
It could very well, because Senator Stanton, through the chair, it could very well, because it's on the top of slide 15, like I mentioned before, the amount of credits that have been issued through the end of 2012, just for the fiscal year 2012, we had issued another $132 million worth of credit certificates. We anticipate that we will get a lot more applications between now and the end of the fiscal year. I don't have a projection for that because it's kind of tough to determine what type of credit applications you're going to be receiving. So quite possibly that number could go up another, you know, a couple hundred million dollars between now and the end of the year, end of the fiscal year.
If I could follow through with that, Mr. Dees, as I understand, 14, there's been 1.7 claimed. You've issued one. You've issued 1.5. So there's at least at the moment approximately $200 million more claimed than issued, and then you anticipate on page 14 that 2012 column to increase from the $118 million to approximately $400 million.
It is, Mr. Chairman, that is correct. It could possibly go up another couple of hundred million.
And if I could jump in real quick, I think some of the disconnect is the number that's in the budget is $400 million. So this is actual through December 2011. So the budget includes that delta, I believe, for the coverage that you're, I think that Senator Stedman is questioning.
All I am is trying to, I shouldn't say all, but what I'm focusing upon is the 2.5 plus the 1.7 is the actually paid out or estimated to be paid out against producers, and the 1.7 is claimed by operators without production, anticipating that that's going to be an additional approximate little less than $300 million, that 118 to 400. And again, the 400 I'm taking from page 31 of the revenue source book at this credits for potential purchase in millions where that 400 is.
Through the chair, the 400 that's in the revenue source book for fiscal year 12, that 400 is the 400 that's on page 13.
Hey,
that
Lenny,
400 is the credits that are going to be used against tax liabilities.
Lenny, let's jump to slide 17. I think this might wrap it up for you nicely. If you could walk us through that slide.
Okay. Slide 17. What this slide is attempting to show is, as of through the end of fiscal year 2012, that the total amount of credits that have either been issued that are available to be redeemed in cash or that have been applied against production tax liability will be about a $3.9 billion figure.
Senator Stedman.
So another way, Mr. Dees, maybe you could give us an estimate of 2012 at the end of the fiscal year, because this is only halfway through 2012.
Well,
and I know on, we have a shiny
On the line that shows the credit applied against production taxability, I mean production tax liability, the $400 million is the 2012 kind of final estimate, right? That's what we're projecting, and that's what's shown in the resource, the revenue sources book on page 31. Okay, now the credits that will be issued between now and the end of the year will be inclusive of the 133 plus what we anticipate to come in by the end of the fiscal year. And I'll, you know, it's like I said, that's a difficult number for us to estimate, but looking at the past, you know, 2 or 3 years of activity, we can estimate that that number will be somewhere in the neighborhood of $300 to $400 million of credits that would have been claimed on applications and that we would have issued as a tax credit certificate that is redeemable for cash.
Which I believe is the number that you had gotten to, Mr. Chairman. Isn't that right? About 4.1 or?
It's north of $4 billion. And, I mean, obviously this shows the complexity of numbers, even amongst people that look at them more than a casual interest. So it's ultimately, I think that the point that needs to be made to the viewing audience is that north of $4 billion figure is Alaska's investment in the North Slope development. And when one looks at FY13, we're anticipating that Alaska's investment in the future is in the range of $875 million for that 1 year alone.
Billion.
Or billion, yeah, $875 million is Alaska's investment under its credit structure in the future.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
That's ultimately, whether it's off a couple hundred million dollars, I guess, I don't want to sound crass, but we're the numbers are all there. We're just trying to get them to be more accurate. So, Mr. Dees, Senator Stedman has a question.
To the commissioners, it made any difference the state putting in at the end of this fiscal year, 4.1, 4.2 billion?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, there are a couple ways to answer that question. The first one, obviously, is from the companies themselves. You know, they would hopefully be able to give you a pretty good idea of what's been spent and potentially what the difference is between the decline we've seen and potentially the decline we could have seen. The other way to look at it is from the Department of Revenue's view, and that's something that we have spent some time working on during the interim, and we talked about this a little bit last legislative session, trying to figure out where the money was going with more specifics and what we were getting for our credits. And that's something that we've put together, a data assessment project. We talked to the companies, and almost all of them got back to us with a five-year look back that dug in a little bit more of what the spending was on. And that's something on a future date that we would be prepared to present for the committee.
Follow-up, Senator Stedman.
Mr. Chairman, maybe they can come back to the committee at a future date. You know, we've got the main credits here, but they also have the ability to do 100% write-off of capital expenditure that has a substantial monetary value. And I'd like estimate from the department on what that is. And we can go back to over these same years, because we've got 4.1 roughly billion on the table in front of us, but an immediate write-off of the capital expenditures is a huge issue also, and we rarely talk about it here, and I think we need to look at this in the entirety when we try to make a policy decision here.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, that's a good point, and that's one of the benefits of working under the net tax system that we are under right now. And in the revenue sources book, we lay out the CapEx and OpEx, capital expenditure, operating expenditure numbers, both on the historical column and then our best projections going forward. So it's very clear in that income statement sheet that you were kind of a proponent of several years back, that walks you through the calculation of the net tax system, and it's very clear what the CapEx and OpEx numbers are there.
Follow up.
But the question really isn't what the capital expenditure is. The question is, what is the monetary value of the ability to immediately write off your capital expenditure, expense it in 1 year or over 2 years? What is that value? We need to understand what that value is within the whole package of our fiscal structure. Because, for instance, if you have a 34% tax rate and you spend $1 billion, that's $340 million. Value of that. Mm-hmm. We need to make sure we understand that value is there and what the value of it is. So when we take a look at making the policy calls, we're looking at the not only our credits but all of the financial mechanisms within it.
Now that's through the chair. Absolutely, Senator Stedman, we'll put that together for you. Okay.
Any further questions? Commissioner, we're getting close to five. I don't know if there's anything additional that we need to present here today. Again, I think we're at the end.
Chairman, we've got four other slide presentations on the thumb drive if you want to stay a couple more hours. But
Well, I think your commissioner is not wanting to do that. But
We will be up, Mr. Chairman, we'll be up again on Monday, and we can tackle a few more of them, and I look forward to it.
Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner, and the entire DOR staff, I believe we're going to be spending some time together in the days to come. But I do appreciate you appearing here today. I think we've established some good facts as far as arising out of this fall 2011 revenue source book and the forecasting and pricing. And thank you very much. Committee members, thank you for being here. Friday afternoon, meeting adjourned.